What's cracking, folks? I'm Jared Dubin, and this is Quo Vadimus. We've got our weekly Friday podcast here talking about the Thursday night TNT games. This week, we had the Thunder and Cavs in Game 1 and the Lakers and Rockets in Game 2. Joined on the other line by Seth Partnow, as usual. Seth, what's up, man?
I'm done.
Pretty good, pretty good.
I'm back in the homeland.
Is it cold there? I mean, I know that Denver, you said, what, like 50 degrees or something. What's the weather like in Alaska right now?
It's all right. There's less snow here than there is in Denver, actually. I got to spend a lovely extra day there, courtesy of a legitimate blizzard. Usually when I'm placing in snows and people freak out, I kind of laugh because it's like, this isn't snow. But the people of Denver, I commend you, that was a legit snowstorm, and you did not panic. So, congratulations.
It's been unseasonably warm in New York lately. It was like in the 60s for 4 or 5 straight days. And I just know that when it gets down to 20 in like a week or so, I'm going to get deathly sick for 2 weeks. It's going to be good times. I'm very excited for it. Happened.
It's probably mid-teens here, so shut up.
It is pouring rain today, though, which is not great.
Okay.
Listen, this is a weather podcast, and I think everyone knows that at this point.
Yes, exactly.
There's a system coming in from the something or other, and it's going to be bad. let's talk about, speaking of systems, let's talk about Oklahoma City and Cleveland. I know that you're going to have a bunch to say about Oklahoma City and Cleveland, both of their teams, their late game execution in this one wound up being a pretty close game down the stretch. Do you want to start there?
Sure. Honestly, the best place to start with this game is what a lot of people are rightly focusing on, and that's Oklahoma City, for not all intents, but for many intents, they give themselves a big hill to climb with their some curious coaching decisions, lineup decisions specifically at the start of the fourth quarter. And, you know, banging on about coaching isn't my favorite thing, but, you know, if you roll out for 3 to 4 minutes, a lineup of, I believe it was Waiters, Singler,
Augustine, and Cantor.
Cantor and Collison was, I believe, the lineup. And, you know, that lineup is bad enough, but playing that lineup for 3 or 4 minutes, the Cavs started the fourth quarter with Love and LeBron James on the floor. And Love went to the bench pretty early for a little bit in the fourth. But just that's, you know, especially with the personnel Cleveland had last night, that's just, you can't leave your all-bench lineup out there to get, you know, to against LeBron. And especially LeBron and Kevin Love. Like, all right, this was, even if that was your planned rotation, and that's, you know, I think we can agree that's probably not a great thing, but maybe there's hashtag reasons for it. You know, even if that's the case, you see that, and you know the other team has one guy who can really, really punish that to the most. You got to change it up, and so that was, you know, that Cleveland went on a big run, and Oklahoma City was, you know, trying to come back from that and just kind of fell short the rest of the game.
Yeah, there are really no reasons, hashtag or otherwise, to sit KD, Russ, and Ibaka all at the same time. Donovan did it at the beginning of the second quarter too. Same lineup: Augustine, Waiters, Singler, Collison, Cantor. And the group that Cleveland was using at the start of the second quarter was slightly different than the one they used at the start of the fourth. It was Jared Cunningham, Richard Jefferson, LeBron, Tristan Thompson, and Varejao to start the second. And that DJ Waiters, Singler, Collison, Kendrick group actually started that quarter 6-0 in 3 minutes, which worked out pretty well for them. Then they came out in the fourth quarter and put Love in Varejao's spot. And, you know, my DVR, as I said on Twitter, did not record the last 10 minutes of this game. But just in the first couple minutes of the fourth quarter, that group with LeBron and Love, along with Thompson, Jefferson, Cunningham, killed that group in the first couple minutes of that fourth quarter. And that was the continuation of a run that they started at the end of the third. It did not work out for old Billy Donovan.
Yeah, So, to be fair, so part of that was a generous four-point play that Love got.
Yeah, and a bullshit continuation call that LeBron got at the start of the fourth quarter as well.
You know what, I tend to not mind kind of the extended continuation on kind of intentional fouls, you know, where a guy's kind of doing on a fast break and try to wrap him up early and maybe he gets the extra step. I don't actually, it may not be the way the rule is written. I don't mind if, you know, we're both soccer fans and I don't necessarily mind if there was some kind of way to build in a little bit more of almost a continuation rule to situations like that, just I know probably from a rule writing standpoint that's largely unworkable, but just from an aesthetic standpoint, I mind that less.
Yeah, let's give the refs more discretion. That would work out really well.
In some cases, maybe so. For example, I think we could save a lot of time on sort of like clear path reviews if it was like just the ref calls it on the floor and it's a slightly less penalty. It's one shot in the ball. Then you know I think that it would be those are always long, pointless reviews. It seems like for what and you kind of have to review it. Because the penalty is so harsh, and that's I think that just from a game flow and still discouraging the play standpoint, because giving up a free point is never and the ball is never the right choice anyway, and that doesn't it's something I've talked about before. That doesn't take away the option to call a flagrant foul if there's like a tackle at midcourt or something like that.
Right.
But I just think that would be a way to streamline that a little bit. Anyway, that's a tangent. So, sorry, go ahead.
Anyway, did you see anything, in the last, the execution in the last 5-6 minutes of the game or so that you especially liked or did not like on either side?
So, I didn't love Oklahoma City calling a timeout. They had the ball, got a rebound, were coming down the floor, down three, and they called a timeout with 25 seconds left. Now, in some cases, a timeout, especially down three, is probably good. For Oklahoma City, where the play you're going to run, is going to be probably going to be Westbrook or Durant taking a three off the dribble over somebody. I'd rather just get that in kind of in almost more in the flow. First of all, because you want the shot to go up a little quicker because you want the chance to get it back if it misses, and it's just going to happen quicker if you go in the flow. And also, just I think that's actually tougher. You're generally speaking probably going to get a tougher shot when the defense can set up most of the timeout also. But that's that's a close judgment call, I think. Because for many teams, I think making sure you get organized and get a good three up is more appropriate. It's just that I don't think Oklahoma City has any time in the last several years been filled with players who are good at executing kind of in that spot. So to some degree that's say. If you want to say that's on the coaches, both of them gotten a lot of slack, Brooks for years and now Billy Donovan. But I also just think if they have, imprecise players, and certainly in late game situations, they'll have three guys on the floor you don't have to guard because Russ or CD is going to take the shot. So that, makes drawing something off the top. Also, and I think that Coach Nick from B-Ball Breakdown actually did a nice job catching this. Their play on the last play was, I think, supposed to be the sideline elevator doors play for Durant, and Steven Adams screened the wrong guy. Kyle Singler was taking the ball out, Singler throws the ball in, and Adams goes to screen his guy on the baseline instead of being like the baseline guy on an elevator doors play. So that's design? Is that Babb's job explaining it, or is that the player screwing up?
Probably some combination of all of them. And, you know, just on the front of having three guys on the court that you don't really need to guard, that's why you got to have them move around and not just stand in one spot. Because then even if you don't have to guard them in terms of thinking they're going to get the ball, it at least forces the other guys in the defense to move around. I don't remember who brought it up on Twitter during the game. I think it might have been Nate Duncan. Oklahoma City's offense still has very little in terms of misdirection or plays that force the defense to choose between one thing or the other and make costly mistakes. You know, it's a lot of high pick and roll with three guys standing around or isolation with four guys standing around. There's not a lot with, you know, multiple or, you know, three, four, five moving parts where the guys both on and off the ball are forced into decisions that prove catastrophic just because whichever thing you choose is going to open up a shot for somebody else. There doesn't seem to be all that much of that for them.
Sure, and actually that's something that's a change and I would say downgrade from last year. I think that you know, people always got mad about that kind of stuff in Scott Brooks' offense. But I think that a lot of their plays, you know, maybe ended up in some kind of spread floor isolations and stuff like that. But the way that they got into them did involve a little bit more kind of a movement and trickery and stuff like that. So you kind of would have a three-man game on one side of the floor where, you know, there's a hit ahead to Collison on the bench post, and he kind of gets the ball to Durant on a handoff and with Westbrook flaring out to the weak side or something like that. Just the entry into the play was a little bit more complex. And then from there, you spread it out what your best two guys were. And you know, on a conceptual level, that always at least made sense. I agree with you and with Nate that they don't even get that much. That it's just kind of, dribble down, guys peace out, and something happens, and it works a lot because, you know, you've got two of the, you know, five or ten best isolation scorers in the league on your team.
Yeah, I mean, those guys can overcome a whole... And look, we're nitpicking. They're one of the, I think, the top three most efficient offenses in the league last time I checked.
That's always the problem talking about Oklahoma City is the danger of elevating form over substance.
Right.
At a certain point, if it works really well with...
They're second, actually.
Pretty limited personnel aside from those two. You know, it is not an easy group to design a functional offense for, both because of the lack of attention needed to get the other players, and also just because, for whatever reason, whether it's just the way they were always going to play, or poor coaching earlier in their career, or given where they both went to college in college. Again, neither Westbrook or Durant are actually precise players in terms of, you know, all right, I'm gonna hold here, come off this pen down, rub really close to the defender, and do stuff like that. They both like to caress the ball, which means, you know, I'm gonna jog out here, catch the ball, my back to the basket, pivot, turn around, face the guy up, do something. Neither of them are quick decision makers, and that, you know, again, makes it difficult. This isn't to absolve anyone else of responsibility, just to say that, you know, a lot of the execution stuff is part and parcel of the players you have.
Right. For what it's worth, our friend Matt Moore said this on Twitter about a half an hour ago as we're recording this. The Thunder are 7-8 in games that have been within 5 points at any point inside the last 5 minutes, and 12-1 in all other games. Now, Matt seems to think that some sort of, you know, just judging based on the tone and where else he went with that string of tweets, seems to think that's some sort of issue. For me, you're going to tend to have a close to 500 record in close games over the long haul. So the fact that they're close to 500 so far this year is basically just indicative that they're a normal team. And then, you know, they blow teams out in all other games. They're 12-1 in games that haven't been within 5 points in the last 5 minutes. Do you agree with either side of that, or what?
I'm much more on your side of that. The close game, like, the very few teams have shown a consistent ability to be, you know, especially good or especially bad, you know, in those close game situations.
But,
and, you know,
the teams that are, though, it's usually teams with, you know, Durant and Westbrook type talents, right? So is this some sort of issue for them that they're not one of those teams, even with those guys?
Maybe. I don't know. You're basing a determination on the team on basically what works out to about like 20 total possessions, right? And it's, you know, over 15 games, it's probably closer to 50 total possessions.
Right. Even if it's all, even if all 5 minutes of that count, then it's, you know, 15 games, 5 minutes. It's, you know, what is that? 75 minutes of play?
Yeah.
No, not 75. I'm bad at math.
No, you're right.
75?
15 is 75.
Okay.
Yeah. It's hashtag analytics. There's structurally things why they're, you know, defensively, I think actually might be the bigger issue for them, and that's, I think, again, comes down to a roster issue, and that something I think we've talked about before. I know I've talked about a lot this year. The lineup everyone wants to see is Durant at the four, Ibaka at the five. Problem is, you got to pick two guys to play the two and three there.
Right.
And you look at their roster and pick two that you're comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, and look, it doesn't matter who we're comfortable with. One of them is going to be Dion Waiters. That's just how it's going to be.
Yeah, that's yikes.
Yeah, you know, they're most, so getting back to just the lineup choices real quick, the Oklahoma City's most used three-man lineup that doesn't have any of Durant, Westbrook, or Ibaka in it is Augustine, Waiters, and Kanter. And it's getting beat by 4.5 points per 100 possessions in over 200 minutes. It's just not, you can't play Kanter and Waiters at the same time. You can't do that.
Yeah, and to be fair, I don't hate the way they're using Kanter. I think that I don't think anyone would.
No, yeah, I saw people talking about how it's a waste of money because they paid him all this much and they're only using him in certain situations off the bench. Like, if you want him to actually be an effective player, those are the only times you can use them.
And the the money they're paying him is it's basically, given where they were heading to the last off season, it's literally only money. There's basically no opportunity cost there because they couldn't have replaced him because they're already over the cap, and they, so essentially if the owner is willing to spend the money, then, you know, there you go. Yeah, I don't think either of us loves him as a player, but they are using him as you would use a player who is getting an appropriate contract for him, a center skill set. And he's been, you know, he's been in that role as kind of a masher against bench units. He's been, you know, pretty effective. You know, he's playing 20 minutes a game, is averaging almost a double-double, double-double is a meaningful thing, but he's been extremely productive in that time. And, you know, if you're deploying him against, you know, not LeBron, that can work. So, you know, that's fine, but then it's also a guy you can't consistently close games with, because I think, you know, as talked about earlier in the year, that's like, you know, one of those guys that you see him in on the floor as the opposition. He's got the flashing neon Edith Joe's sign, you know, run pick and roll at this guy, kind of thing. So, and this
We've talked about it before. They have, you know, it's all one-way players. There's nobody really beyond the three big guys of KD, Russ, and Ibaka that plays on both ends.
Yeah, like there's not even a guy who is as credible like two-way as like a Matt Barnes, right? Not the greatest offensive player, but you know, a guy who moves the ball, hits some jump shots. You know, if he's their fifth guy on the floor, all right, maybe it's not perfect, but it's all right. They don't have a guy even that balanced. Either it's, you know, it's Roberson who hit one of the more comical threes of the year, where he caught the ball with 15 feet of space. I don't even think I'm exaggerating in the corner, and like hesitated, pump faked, traveled, and it wasn't called, and then finally shot it after holding the ball for like 3 seconds and made it. And it was like, that's a made shot that makes me want to guard you even less there. And it's just, you know, Nate calls it a record scratch. That's exactly, no finer example of that, where at the end of the offense is moving and the ball gets to a guy and just everything stops, right? You know, like as he, like, kicks in the door of the saloon and the piano player stops and everyone looks at the guy. It's what happens every time the ball finds Roberson open on the perimeter.
He passed up one of those early in the game, too, after Ibaka passed up a jumper above the free throw line and kicked it to him in the corner. He passed up a wide open three and for some reason took a floater over Mozgov. Did not go well. It was not fun. Later in that first quarter, though, this is something that really bothered me. And I'm not even a Dion Waiters guy, but you know, the game being played in Cleveland, obviously Waiters was traded from Cleveland to Oklahoma City, and the fans were vociferously booing him when he came onto the court. It's not like he asked to be traded from Cleveland. He wanted to be the guy that stayed there and played with LeBron. He wasn't especially good there, but those fans were all, you know, ride or die. Deion Waiters and Kyrie Irving is the best backcourt in the league. Waiters is so good as a spot-up shooter. Like, it's just hypocritical. Like, stop.
Well, so that actually is something that I think a lot of kind of those kind of fan reactions are people, you know, it's kind of the flip side of the premature, like, anointing of players and stuff like that is then, you know, when you know, someone performs actually closer to what, you know, you could have reasonably expected to them, people get mad and take it personally. You know, it's I think, you know, with the Pelicans this year, people are mad and angry because they thought that, you know, the Pelicans were magically, despite, you know, an injury-prone, lopsided roster, were going to be great this year. Now they aren't. I mean, they're mad, and they're... And, you know, but as Pelicans fans, there's NBA fans, there's kind of lashing out at you know, Alvin Gentry and Anthony Davis, at whoever. And it's, you know, if you build someone up kind of too far and then take it personally when they don't perform to the expectations which weren't reasonable to begin with, that's what you get. And so I think that the nastiness of Deion Waiters for not being a part of the best backcourt in the NBA when that was, you know, silly at the time, that's what you get.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I do want to talk about a couple of things Cleveland-related before we move on to the second game. First was when they came back from halftime, Craig Sager had a report that said, David Blatt says LeBron does not like playing backup point guard against Oklahoma City and that he prefers to work underneath. I'm wondering where that comes from. You know, why specifically against Oklahoma City he doesn't like doing that. Can you think of anything off the top of your head that would lead him to especially not like playing backup point against the Thunder in particular?
Not really. I didn't think of it. That is kind of odd. And you know, it's not like, you know, if he was going to be guarded by, you know, someone
Right, it's not like Westbrook is pestering him all night, you know?
It's not like, you know, if it was Houston and in that situation would, like, have him being guarded by Patrick Beverley. It's like, all right, I can see how that would be no fun.
But even that, Houston's not going to do that. They're not going to put Patrick Beverley on him.
Yeah, I don't know. That's
I just thought it was interesting strange, that they brought that up. Yeah. But if I don't have any idea and you don't have any idea, maybe it's just a LeBron personal preference type thing.
Yeah.
So the second thing I wanted to bring up, our friend Conrad, this is going to sound bad. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. I think it's Kaczmarek. Conrad K. He brought up during the game about Matthew Dellavedova. Someone was like, he's not good at anything except trying. And Conrad said...
I don't think that's right.
Yeah, well, that's where I'm going with it. Just give me one second here. Conrad said that he's an elite three-point shooter because he's a career 42% shooter on over 400 attempts. That was something that struck me a lot, so I went and did some digging. You know, he shot 40, I can't remember off the top of my head, I think 46% as a rookie, and then 30% last year, and he's up above 40 again this year. But coming into last night's game, 54 of his 63 attempts from three were described by the NBA as either open or wide open, which means the closest defender was at least 4 feet away. So if a guy is shooting really well on almost all, you know, NBA wide open attempts, you know, if the defender's not within 4 feet, generally an NBA player is wide open. Do you can still consider that person an elite shooter?
So two things. First of all, I think there was some kind of back and forth about this offseason, which we don't need to get into right now. But especially on three-pointers, I think a better definition of open and wide open is 6 and 10 feet. Just that's how the numbers break down. I think the 6 feet is about, you know, players shoot below NBA average when they're closer and above NBA average when they're further than about 6 feet. So I think that's a better definition again of open, and then ahead you get up to 10 feet and the percentages jump again because that's your pickup game open. Is the closest defender 10 feet away. So but the point still stands, I think, that even so, if he is hitting 40% on those open shots, that's very good. Now, whether he's an elite shooter, I don't know. I think because, you know, a guy like Kyle Korver shoots high 40s and with the vast majority of his threes, you know, contested, either semi-contested, heavily contested, and he still is knocking them down under that pressure. So that's you know, categorically different than Dellavedova. Second, 400 career attempts is not enough to say, you know, with great certainty. It's certainly a good sign if he's hitting, you know, 40% of his threes over you know that sample. I think Daryl Blackford, one of the Nylon Calculus writers, has kind of set the line to you know, when you can say something confidently about someone's 3-point shooting is about 750 attempts, which, you know, is more than a single season for most players. I think every player basically.
Yeah. Just a quick correction on his percentages, though. I was actually looking at his 2-point percentages. He shot 36.8% on 155 attempts as a rookie, 40.7 on 167 attempts last year, and 44.3 on 70 attempts already this year. 39.8% for his career, going up every year on more and more attempts. So, you know, maybe there is some sort of trend there, but.
I think in general, I think he has improved as a player this year. Something that I like.
Yeah, I think his defense has been better this year, you know, for the most part, than it was last season when he gained sort of a cult hero reputation for doing, you know, an oversold job a little bit in the first few games of the finals, even though he did do pretty well.
He was standing near Steph Curry when Steph Curry missed some shots.
Although, you know, to be fair, being near Steph Curry when he misses shots is a lot more than other people managed to do. They were nowhere near him as he made shots.
I think a lot of people, especially this year, have been near Steph Curry and then he has made shots. So, assigning credit to guys missing jump shots to the closest defender is, it's basically, I think it's, at this point, I really don't think it's appropriate to say, well, he's defended well because guys are shooting this on jump shots and he hit them. I think that that's, you know, you look year to year and there's basically, you know, we don't have a ton of data on it yet, but we look year to year and there's very little correlation year to year. And if it was a discernible skill, you would kind of see something that looked less like a random walk.
And that's something that Chris Herring from the Wall Street Journal just wrote about with Carmelo Anthony, who last year was, I think, the worst in the league in terms of players making three-pointers when he was, quote-unquote, guarding them. And this year he's, I think, second best. And almost half of that improvement has come from him being the closest guy when he's 5-plus feet away. And last year, players made 50% of those threes, and this year they're making 29%. You know, that's how much those numbers can be thrown off.
Yeah, and neither of those numbers are especially reflective of anything Carmelo is doing.
Right.
You know, nobody should 50%. Like, people don't 50%. On jumpers, you know, that doesn't really happen. Over a broad sample in NBA game conditions.
Unless you're like Dirk.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Dirk, Al Horford are kind of the like, not even, you know, not even LaMarcus Aldridge, whose reputation as a mid-range shooter to some extent actually exceeds his achievement, but that's neither here nor there. But the point I wanted to make is Dellavedova. I think he's improved as an offensive player, as a point guard. Shooting, you know, more confidently, his release has gotten quicker, he's still throwing a lot of those crazy lobs, but they seem to be, you know, judging by his assist to turnover rate, they have been wiser in general.
Yeah, they're connecting more often. I'm happy to see that less of them are going into the stance.
Yeah, and I think he has, you know, having, it's something you kind of see at times where a guy, you know, maybe he's a fringe player and then establishes himself as actually an NBA player, and then kind of, whether it's just, you know, the security of having a little bit of a contract or knowing they, an offseason, knowing they belong, knowing what they need to work on, you know, they kind of step up a little bit because of these improvements in the skill areas that were maybe lacking a little bit.
Well, I think it's also, you know, he knows his spot in the rotation is secure too, especially with Kyrie being out. He's going to play, you know, 28, 29 minutes a game as the starting point guard for LeBron's team. And that sort of certainty, I think, helps guys a lot.
And also, I mean, you mentioned with LeBron, and also, like, LeBron obviously has confidence in him. Like, when LeBron is penetrating the basket, he is actively looking for Dellavedova on the wing, so he is getting the ball kind of in untied and in spots where he can kind of shoot in rhythm, and that obviously is a helpful thing.
Yeah. Do you have anything else on this first game before we move on to Houston and the Lakers?
I think we covered everything. I think it was certainly an entertaining game, even if it wasn't. Especially down the stretch, the cleanest played game of the season. It was a good win for Miami, given that you know, probably their three best guards were out. So, good win for Miami. Slightly disappointing loss for OKC.
Yeah. So, okay, let's go on to game number two. And before we get into the actual game, and look, I hate that we have to do this every week where we have to talk about, you know, nonsense that Reggie Miller talks about during whichever game he announces. He basically just used this game as like an infomercial for Kobe's career. It got to the point where it was embarrassing, the level to which he was caping for Kobe being able to just do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, because he's been a great player. I mean, there's no one denying that he's been a great player. But to sit there and say that he should just shoot as many times as he wants, and that doesn't adversely affect the development of young guys like Clarkson and Russell and Randall because the ball's not in their hands. I mean, I actually tried to write down a quote from him, and it was too difficult to understand. It was like, Reggie, he's like, I hate this notion that Kobe should shoot less to show Clarkson and Russell how to play. He should shoot as much as he wants to shoot because these guys don't know how to play the game of basketball yet. And I stopped writing from there because it was impossible to understand what the fuck he was talking about. And he just went on and on about the same exact point throughout the game. Like, the Clarkson, Russell, and Randall at one point were on the court without Kobe, and he was like, oh, let's see how they do without an all-time legend on the floor. You're telling me this guy should shoot less? And then Kobe makes a three, and he's like, shoot less? Shoot less? He should shoot less? Like, yeah, he should fucking shoot less and shouldn't shoot 20 shots a game like he was early in the season. Notice how he's shooting and playing better now because he's not taking, 12 ridiculous threes a night. These last five or six games, he's shooting much better. You know, over 47% from the field, over 37% from three. I think he's only taking 15 shots a night as opposed to whatever it was before that, 38 shots a night.
I actually looked this up just because it's been, his numbers have been better. He kind of looks like he's got his legs under him a little bit and kind of, he had his first dunk of the year last night.
Yeah, and oh my God, that dunk. Oh my God.
A little throwback there. But no, he's been taking, the last five games, he's been taking about 14 and a half shots a night. And his, he's actually been, to be fair to him, got, pillory. Really, he's playing decently well.
He looks good.
Half shots a night, 56% effective field goal percentage, 58% true shooting. Whether he can extend that over any period of time, but no, he's been an actually effective player. And part of it is, again, as you said, because there's fewer of these kind of ridiculous shots going up, and some of that actually might be, they may have, the Lakers may have actually backed into a better quote unquote playing rotation. Actually, kind of moving guys who need the ball away from Kobe a little bit in terms of letting Russell and Randall, with Randall especially, by the way, I think play off the bench against second units some.
Yeah, especially because Randall, strange as it is, operates from a lot of the same spots that Kobe does. Near the elbow and on the left block.
Yeah, and I don't love Randall's game going forward. Kind of for that reason, and that he's got almost almost an old school game in the way that he just wants to very much likes to almost like we talked about earlier with Durant Westbrook, likes to press the ball and size things up from the perimeter. And if you're Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant, those are things that maybe make some sense. If you're Julius Randle, that's maybe not the recipe for an especially efficient offense. So I would like to see him put in a situation where he is required to just make quicker decisions with the ball, because there are some skills there. They're just not being utilized in a way that's conducive to a kind of modern, effective NBA offense.
It's,
even going forward, even as they're developing him.
It's going to sound like a...
Not,
it's going to sound like a strange comparison, but he sort of reminds me of Carmelo in that sense, where he'll get the ball at the elbow, face up, survey the defense for 2 seconds, take his time, decide to make his move, and then make his move. Randle does a lot of that too. And then you see, like, you know, once a game or once every couple games where he faces up and just sort of goes right away and blows right by his guy and goes right to the basket, and it's so easy. And you're just like, why doesn't he just do that every time? That happens with Carmelo a lot too, and I think it happens with Randle as well. Forcing a guy to make quick decisions with the ball when he has quickness off the dribble, especially when he faces up bigger defenders, that's going to benefit him. You know, I don't know how to get him to do that other than to just say, do it. But he should.
Yeah, and, you know, that's actually, you know, that kind of sort of belies the general Reggie Miller point there, because it's very much a do as they say, not as they do thing, where you've got, you know, another guy who is kind of the patron saint of, you know, catching the ball on the mid wing and then surveying and taking his time and all that stuff. You're saying that he should watch and learn from that. Well, what's he going to watch and learn?
Right.
So that's kind of to your point about why, you know, some of the indulging that the Lakers, or all of the indulging of Kobe that the Lakers did early in the season was not helpful. And again, it's stuff that as he's playing better, Kobe has been doing less of now. He's been, you know, catching the ball on the move, getting to the basket. There's several, you know, not just a dunk, but there's several times where he kind of caught the ball on a cut and made a move. And, you know, there's one play in the first half where he kind of made like a slice cut from the corner, caught the ball just outside the paint, pump faked Dwight up in the air,
yep,
and shot a layup. And that's like,
that was beautiful. That was great. Yeah. Exactly. So just two more jumping off points from Reggie related stuff before we move away from him. One of my biggest pet peeves for analysts is they'll be making some sort of point and then just inject play by play into it. Like one point in the second quarter, Reggie was talking about how, you know, he was wrong, obviously, about the point he was making, but he's like, oh, you know, Kobe will never lose his jumper. And Harden with a nice drop down there to Howard. And then he continued making his point about Kobe and the jumper. Like, the game is on TV. We can see that Harden just dropped the ball down to Howard. You don't need to interrupt your point and tell us that. He does that all the time. Jeff Van Gundy does a lot, too. It's strangely for me a weird pet peeve that I have. Does that bother you at all, or am I just really weird?
I think it probably bothers me more when Reggie does it than Jeff Van Gundy does it, because JVG is probably making a point that's at least entertaining, if not insightful, and often both. Whereas, anyway, this is a kind of a tired topic, and they, you know, do better.
Right.
You know, these are the games that, you know, are the flagship games, and you know, if people rightly or wrongly like take their cue for how to observe and take in the NBA from what is said in these games, and it's whether it's in the studio or at the games, like, it do better. That's all.
Yeah. And so the other thing was, and this is not just a Reggie thing, this is widespread throughout, I think, a lot of announcers throughout the league, where they'll default to energy level as an explanation for poor play. And this happened early on in the game where the Lakers were sort of getting killed on the glass on the defensive end. And they were like, oh, the Lakers have just come out with no energy tonight. Houston is offensive rebounding really well. Houston is a top third offensive rebounding team in the league, and the Lakers are 27th in defensive rebounding. Like, that's just a mismatch for them. Like, it's not because the Lakers aren't trying. You know, and this is something that I think, why do you think it is that announcers sort of default to energy level and not trying hard as an explanation for poor play?
You know, I don't think it's just announcers. I think it's something, I was in Denver, like I said, this last week, and you know, they Mike Malone, who I think is doing a nice job as a coach. You know, he like when Denver was losing, he was talking about their effort level, and really, they don't have a lot of talent, and they weren't playing harder when they started winning. They just started playing better. They might have been playing a little bit harder, but in general, it's not like they were. There wasn't an absence of effort. The Timberwolves are going through a rough patch right now. They're playing badly. They're throwing the ball all over the gym. They're not playing hard. They're just making really dumb decisions.
And they're also just not that good of a team. Like, they got guys that are going to be extremely good, but right now they're just good, and then the rest of the team is not good.
And the point I want to make here, though, is that you know, the Lakers' opponent last night, I agree with you. I don't like defaulting to effort, but if there's, you know, a team in the league
who, yes,
many games, the lack thereof is just glaring. It's been Houston, and that's why, like, you know, just watch, you know, if you want to see, like, lack of effort for much of a, like, you know, lack of professional effort for much of a game, watch, you know, the first 43 minutes of Houston's game versus Denver on Monday, where I was there for. You know, the difference between that and, like, oh, they're not trying hard, you know, actually they're just getting beat, you know. It really does stick out what an actual, like, low effort level looks like, and it's not something we should default to. I think it's there's probably more going on than that, because, you know, yes, the effort level in the regular season is lower than it is in the playoffs. That just is. I mean, I think, you know, in anyone's job, there are times of the year which are kind of, you know, crunch time. If you're, you know, where we both have backgrounds as an attorney, like, do you work harder, like, the day before you have a, you know, a hearing or a trial starting than you do? Yeah, you, like, that's, you know, that's the 18-hour day you put in, because it's, you know, there's you know, and that's in any profession, there are times where you know, okay, I'm working hard enough. This is a base level, and then there are times where I have to work harder than that, and that's, you know, regular season versus playoffs in the NBA. I think that it's important to recognize that, you know, expecting that level of manic intensity, you know, for 7-8 months is not realistic. You know, there are guys, you know, your Kevin Garnett's in his prime who could do that, but that's the exception rather than the rule.
Speaking of Houston-related things that suck, Ty Lawson, man. What?
Yeah.
Thoughts?
I don't know. It's strange to me.
Look, I mean, obviously the guy has some personal issues that, you know, we know about off the court with his drinking. I don't know if those have been happening throughout this season as well, you know, but just in terms of what he's been able to do when he's been in games, I mean, he's just a disaster right now. 33% from the field, 29% from three, even worse over the last five games. He has 9 points total in the last five games, none in the last two, shooting 20% from the field and 14% from three over the last five. I mean, it wasn't long ago, like the beginning of last season, he was a top 10 point guard in the league. I mean, it's one of the most stunning falls I can ever remember.
you could say, all right, well, they're playing next to Harden and asking him to play like Patrick Beverley, and that's not the best use of his skills. Well, now they've moved him to the second unit and kind of giving him the opportunity to play a role that is closer to like kind of what you think he should play, and he's just not getting it done, and that's disconcerting. And if
they're even giving him guys to play with that, you know, fit what you think of as Ty Lawson's skill set, like, you know,
right.
Corey Brewer will get out and run. Yeah. Terrence Jones will get out and run. And still they're not doing really any of that. It's pretty wild.
I mean, we can only hope that it's just a guy in a for his sake, is having agreed to non-guaranteed the second year, the last year of his contract. We can only hope that he's a guy just going through a miserable slump rather than, small, quick point guard with not a great jump shot. Maybe when it's gone, it's gone, and maybe it's gone for him.
Let's say that this continues throughout the rest of the season. What happens with
him?
No way they bring him back. Sorry?
There's no way they bring him back if this is what they get all season.
Oh, no, I would imagine, obviously, they're not bringing him back. They're just going to cut him loose. But what happens with him contract-wise after that? You know, look at Rondo last season. Not quite as bad as Lawson this year. But similarly, you know, off-court problems, a player that used to be very good suddenly was not good at all, still managed to get $10 million, but because that's the Kings. So what happens? Do you think something similar would happen with Lawson? There's so much money available this summer that I feel like somebody would pony up to get him, but it seems like one of those situations where they'd be bidding against themselves.
Yeah, I mean, just remind me. I mean, obviously, in recent news, Rondo has been in it for very bad and unacceptable reasons. But what did he have off court problems?
Feuding with Rick Carlisle, feuding with Monte Ellis, feuding with everybody on the Mavericks. They basically shut him down in the middle of the playoffs and said, "Don't come around here no more."
That's still that's off-court problems, and I certainly think of like legal troubles. I
meant non-gameplay related problems, okay. I guess.
Yeah. And those work, I think, an extension of gameplay related problems at the very least. So I think that almost that. Lawson is kind of categorically different in that, you can at least say that to the extent that one is willing to give Rondo the benefit of the doubt right now, those were, that was bad, personality mix. And it's easier to talk yourself into we can fix that here than it is, a guy who just can't play.
Right.
And right now, Lawson just can't play. Assuming this keeps up in Houston, that doesn't bring him back, does someone sign him? Maybe?
I think somebody does. Somebody is like, oh, we could tap into what was there.
I have a hard time seeing it be for, even a team like desperate for backup point guard play like Chicago. Would they sign him for, the biannual for, whichever MLE they qualify for next year?
Why wouldn't Philly try to get him on a cheap one-year deal? If they're going to try to start winning next season. And he's available for nothing.
That's the question of which way is Philly trying to go next year?
I assume Colangelo was brought in to be like a parent and be like, we're going to start trying now.
Yeah, no, but I'm just saying, would signing Lawson be like a you want veterans, here's a veteran stealth tank move, or would that actually, it's like you said, he's been, if this is what he gets all year, I mean, he's performing at a sub-NBA level.
Yeah.
Um, and, guarantee at this point.
I think that somebody will. I think somebody talks themselves into him. But we'll see.
I mean, Dollars to Donuts is probably, he's probably in the NBA next year somewhere. It's just, the point is that even a conversation is a pretty damning indictment of how he has performed so far this year. And really, I know that the time I liked
Yeah, two more things I want to bring up before we finish up here. I'm wondering, does SportView track cross-court passes? Just off the top of my head, the Rockets threw like 900 of them in this game. And not the kind where, you know, you throw it across the court and it creates, a driving lane because you're moving the defense around. It was like from one side of the court in the corner, clear across to the other, because that was the only thing that was open somehow. And they threw it out of bounds, actually, on three different occasions. It was really, really strange. I don't know if that's something that exists, probably somewhere in the non-public archives, but I thought that was really interesting.
I think it's something you could with the full data pull out pretty easily, but it's not something that exists. The general answer is anything that involves ball or player movement, yes, you could find it in SportView. It's just a matter of spending the time and whether such a question would be useful to you. I think that in general, the contrast you're drawing with a cross court pass that moves the defense around, those aren't valuable things. That's kind of if you compare like good offensive teams to bad offensive teams to good teams. Probably move the ball side to side more, especially with the prevalence of kind of strong side overload defenses. Well, I mean, there's less guys on the weak side, and so if you swing the ball, then you're attacking at an advantage. But to answer your question, it's not something that's tracked publicly. At least once I get access to a full data set, I will of course dive into that. And then tell nobody, because once I get access to the full data set,
I
won't be allowed to talk about it publicly. So, there you go.
Right. So, the other thing that I wanted to bring up was, I'm wondering, if this is something that our favorite nerds at Nylon Calculus can track. Harden's three-point percentage on those threes that he sort of walks into in transition... anecdotally, it seems like he takes a ton of them, and I'm not sure that he shoots all that well on them, just, from watching
this year,
games.
This year, I would agree with you. Last year, he was without having the numbers in front of me, he was pretty good on kind of threes off the dribble, threes kind of in situations where he had the ball a while. So, that's one of the areas in which he is just, for whatever reason, whether it's conditioning or focus or just not playing well, that's one of the areas where he is just not performing to nearly the level he was at last year.
Right.
And yes, he does take a lot of those, and so him shooting 30% instead of 42%, and that's. Guessing from memory on that kind of shot. That's a big deal. It's a big difference.
Definitely. Do you got anything more on these games? That's all I got in my notes here.
No. I mean, I think we covered the fact that Kobe is playing better. I'm glad the first game was at least a good one.
One of these weeks we'll get two good games on Thursday night. It will not be next week because Next Thursday is Christmas Eve. There are no games on Thursday. I don't know what we're going to do podcast-wise. Maybe we'll talk about some of the Christmas games after that.
I think I'll be lucky to even be able to catch the Warriors-Cavs games on Christmas.
All right, so maybe there's going to be no podcast next week. We'll figure something out. Maybe something earlier in the week. Who knows? We'll figure it out. The following week, also, there are no Thursday national TV games because that's New Year's Eve. So we'll figure something out for the next 2 weeks and let people know. You can follow Seth on Twitter at Seth Partnow. Follow me at JADubin5. You can find all of the podcasts from Hardwood Paroxysm and the HP Basketball Network at hardwoodparoxysm.com by clicking on the link in the upper right corner for the HP Basketball Network Podcast Center. You can also find us on iTunes under Hardwood Paroxysm, HP Basketball Network, or the name of this podcast, Quo Vadimus. We will have some news on the podcast front fairly soon, so stay tuned for that as well. Seth, thanks for coming on, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.